Okay, I mean, on the face of it, it would seem as if they ought to be able to. They don't seem to have done very well. But what they can do in Russia, all state industries, so to speak, are on one budget. So if a particular industry in Russia is making a loss, it doesn't matter, it doesn't go out of business. They don't have bankruptcies. In other words, the government can use the total revenue it gets from all the state industries and use it to support an industry in difficulties, or use it to invest more capital in it. As long as the whole lot makes a profit, which they do, because they depend on it for their budget, a third of their income is profits of state in enterprises, but each particular one doesn't have to survive. Whereas in this country, there comes a point where, you read in your papers yesterday, if the American oil company, which owns the Observer, continues to make a profit, they'll close it down. And you see, that couldn't happen in Russia, because it's all run on the state budget. But the cost they pay, according to various people who've looked at it, is an enormous overmanning of industry. They keep their unemployment on the payroll. Yeah, but increase in productivity isn't a question of money or price. It's a question of measuring productivity in physical terms. In other words, if it takes 10 workers to produce a commodity and you can improve production methods and get it produced by 8 workers instead of 10, that's a physical thing. You don't have to go into questions of money or money supply or price or anything like this. And over British capitalism, for the last 20 years, the government publish a thing every year, National Income, a blue book. And they work out a figure, they make a calculation, a very complicated thing, but they had a lot of experience on it now. They work out, so to speak, what is the total physical output of British capitalism in a year. And they do it for, they carry it back 20 years back, you can go back right to 1938. And then they measure it against, or you can, measure it against the total number of workers. And on this basis, the workers' output increased in the last 20 years about 2% a year. Whereas Strachey and the others, and Adam Smith, didn't realise that that's the way you must work it out. They worked it out in another way, which is pure nonsense. Strachey worked his one out. One of his examples was the Austin Motor Company, and he measured the number of cars produced by Austin over a period of years and the number of workers employed in the factory, overlooking the fact, of course, that the bulk of the labour required to produce motor cars is not in the assembly plant at all, it's in producing the raw material, the iron ore, the steel, the glass, the rubber, and all the rest of it. It was the same mistake Adam Smith made, same mistake Strachey made, and incidentally, it was obviously the same mistake Engels made. They didn't apply their own theory to it, so to speak. You've got to measure output in physical terms. I've already mentioned to you there are figures the government now produces where they incorporate the same mistake. They measure miners' output and agricultural workers' output by the amount of stuff produced each year, amount of coal, amount of food, and they measure it against the number of people employed on farms and in mines. Well, the most miners and most agricultural workers don't now work on farms and in mines. They work in factories producing fertilisers and machinery and so on for the industry. And you've got to take that into account, measure on a physical basis, and they don't do it. Well, I did mention, I told you the capitalists are competing to expand the size of their production. This is what goes on. And when I mention the fact, you see, that the production industries lag behind the consumption, this is what goes on. And of course, I mention the fact that it's cheapness thereafter. So each one tries to expand the scale of his production because it reduces unit costs and he can then sell the thing more cheaply. The whole thing's obscured now, of course, by inflation, but it goes on all right. They operate in competition, yes. Oh, no, but then they're both, in both of them, they're all competing, all the capitalists are competing, you see. In both the consumer goods industries and the production goods industries, they're all competing with each other, and with foreign capitalists. But the imbalance, see, even apart from that, Marx does, in fact, the way Marx sets it out, he does deal with it first on the assumption that you haven't got this capitalist urge to expand the scale of production for its own sake, and treats it first as a simple problem. The imbalance and disproportion will still happen. You'll still get certain industries overproducing for their particular market. I mean, suppose it's the motor car. If they overproduce for their particular market, they immediately stop production, start standing workers off, stop expanding their industry, and then, if it's big enough, you've got a crisis. But then, as Marx said, as capitalism develops, it becomes more complicated because the capitalists are no longer producing in response to a demand for their product. They get to a stage where they're expanding for its own sake, because they either expand or they disappear.
On the question of production of arms to get out of the crisis, you said that not producing arms doesn't cause a crisis, and producing arms doesn't produce food. Well, doesn't it contribute towards keeping a stable economy? Because, for instance, if there is a crisis and the armaments manufacturers can convince governments that there isn't a profit to be made from producing more arms, or a defensive profit to be made from producing more arms, then that does provide jobs. It provides also a group of things like the steel industry and of course the munitions industry and science and technological research. And I've heard the figure that within the next 5 years, the present British government is going to have to change all of the armaments it's got at the moment and build up new ones. Now, that only happens, I think, or at least it would seem, from the armament and the munitions industrialist lobby, who constantly invent new weapons, sell them to one country, and then force another country to have to buy them in order to compete. And in that sense, can help them to buy their way out of the crisis.
You're assuming that capitalists can buy themselves out of the crisis.
Well,
see, and they can't. The capitalists will only start expanding when they see a profit in it. Now, you say the armament lobby, of course, can make a profit out of armament. But look at it from the point of view of the rest of the capitalist class. The rest of the capitalist class don't want to help the armament people to make arms by increasing taxation spending on armaments. They try to resist it. They want to keep the cost as low as it possibly can. And remember this too. In a boom, the rest of the capitalists don't want the government to spend more on armaments. In 1950, the Labour government decided on a rearmament programme, and they announced they were going to spend, I've forgotten what the figure was, another 700 million or something like this, on armaments. A year later, the Prime Minister, Attlee, reported to the House of Commons they hadn't spent the money and they hadn't increased the armaments, because they couldn't get labour to do it. If they expanded armaments, the only way they could do it was with pulling workers out of the jobs they'd already got in other industries and putting them into armaments. So in fact, the thing hadn't happened. In short, there was a physical limit. In a boom, there was a physical limit to production. I've mentioned all these 50% of firms in 1973 who were complaining they got more orders than they could fill. They couldn't get raw materials, they couldn't get skilled workers, they couldn't get all the other things. They don't want the government to step in there and start producing armaments and make the situation worse. Now, it's in a depression they might look to do this, but then armament expenditure is no different, say, from increasing the size of the civil service. I mean, and it's the same sort of thing that happens.
Yeah, but well, there are two points. One of them is I can't see any resistance within the capitalist class at the moment to expenditure on arms in order to defend their markets. I mean, a number of the top companies are directly supporting the Tory party's defence programme, partnered with funds. Others are supporting organisations that themselves support the Tory party. Many of them are supporting all kinds of sort of nationalistic movements, whipping up ideas of war. And I can see very little organised resistance from there, not much from the working class, unfortunately, as well, but certainly, you know, I haven't seen the signs. But the other thing is about causing the crisis is, if the capitalist class, or section of the capitalist class were large enough to say that they wanted to have, say, unilateral disarmament. I would say that would spell almost the final nail in the coffin of the British steel industry. It would affect certainly the British munitions industry, which I think is one of the largest exports in this country. And it would mean that a lot of capitalists would go to the war. So again, I would say that that in itself could contribute towards at least a crisis of sorts in one area of British industry.
Well, I mean, you see, any change will cause a disturbance. But we're not talking about something which causes a disturbance, causes a crisis which leads to a depression. I mean, an attack against it. I mentioned the fact that 1945 to 1951, armament expenditure was cut by three quarters. There was no depression. It's just like any other sort of expenditure. And when you say...
Oh, but cut by three quarters in 45 to 51... But that was a cut on wartime expenditure.
Exactly.
But wartime expenditure is always about 10 times more than peacetime expenditure. So three quarters cut in expenditure between 45 and 51.
No, but wait a minute, you've forgotten. The people who used this argument in the Communist Party said there will be a Great Depression because of cutting armament expenditure. They're not. This is their theory.
I mean, it was only a cut down to normal peacetime.
What is the theory, you see? The theory put forward is that armament expenditure is different from other sorts of expenditure. And that if you're in a depression and you increase armament expenditure, you'll get out of the depression. Well, it didn't happen when they cut expenditure, and it didn't happen when they increased expenditure in 1950-51. The new rearmament program. One thing, of course, they couldn't increase expenditure because they couldn't get workers and couldn't get materials. But when you say the capitalists as a whole are not interested in cutting expenditure, look what the Tories are doing. The Tories, it's true, are spending more on armaments, but at the same time they're cutting expenditure, trying to cut government taxation and everything else. But in the 19th century it was the Liberals who ruined the government for the whole half of the 19th century. It was their program. Peace, retrenchment and reform. And, of course, incidentally, on occasion, actually opposing wars, like Lloyd George opposing the Cold War. Capitalists are no one. I mean, some of them may see a particular interest in the war, but the capitalist class also know they could pay for it. But it's just like any other expenditure. It has the same sorts of results if you, like spending more on the health service or increasing the size of the civil service. At the time it happens, that will create some more jobs. But over a period, it didn't make any difference to capitalism's booms and depressions. Either it's a question of increasing it or decreasing it. The result is just the same. The capitalist lobby, I mean, there's an armament lobby, of course, there's a brewer's lobby and all sorts of other lobbies. But now the rest of the capitalist class take a different view.
Didn't the German capitalist class under Hitler help to solve their problem by increasing arms expenses?
They solved, yes, which problem you were trying to solve? They were going to war. To go to war, they had to have armaments. But their other problem, and if you like their political problem, unemployed, they put the unemployed in uniform like Roosevelt did in America in the conservation problem. That's rather a different matter. They had to support the unemployed, and they got them off the labour market by putting them in the uniform and Hitler and... Roosevelt putting them in the conservation corps, taking them off the labour market. I mean, that solves their whatever problem they've got from unemployment as a problem. But I mean, see, why should armament expenditure be different from anything else? Any other form of expenditure?
Because it's totally unnecessary.
Totally necessary. Capitalists can't do without armament expenditure.
They could, but there's no fixed amount that they require. In other words, they can constant, when one side pushes up their armaments expenditure, the other side is forced to do it as well. And therefore the industry can force them through international competition into a compulsion to produce to a higher standard.
I mean, one obvious thing occurs to me, why didn't the armament industry succeed, and of course, some of them are saying so, why didn't they succeed in maintaining armament expenditure at more or less the wartime level? some of them were arguing for this, some of them were saying, look, this war's finished in 1945, it's going to resume very shortly, keep it up to wartime level. I mean, from the armament or expenditure point of view, okay, but not from the point of view of the capitalist class as a whole. But in any event, if this were true, you've got to show somewhere where it actually happened. You've got to show some depression that they've recovered from by increasing armament expenditure, or some depression that's been created by reducing armament expenditure. And capitalism takes practically no notice. There's always a little disturbance. I mean, if they cut the civil service drastically, of course there'll be a bit of a disturbance there, I think, in the industrial zone, making a difference to the way capitalism runs.
In relation to disproportion, you mentioned the silicon chip industry. I read the other day that the company which was supported by the national, what do they call it, the national organisation which gives money, Enterprise Corp, isn't it? The company is gone into liquidation.
That's one of them, and
there are others, I know, but I mean the one that was supported by the government has gone into liquidation.
That's the one that General Electric were interested in and have walked out.
That's right.
But in America, you see the silicon chip companies, people making it, and the people applying it to products after the time being doing very well. I mean, it was inevitable. A new industry comes along, and for the time being, they do very well, and inevitably, within 2 or 3 years, they will have overproduced for that particular industry. This always happens.
Well, they were at the same time talking about another company, I think, partly owned by America, by some American company, up in Leeds or Wolverhampton, and it's got tremendous orders. It's a peculiar situation, though, isn't it? If you've got one that's supported by the government, it's supposed to be a boom industry. They go bankrupt. They're in a bankruptcy court.
Yes, but I mean, the GEC have got an argument here. GEC say that Britain's got in too late and they can't now overtake the Americans. Mm-hmm. And so that the money they put into it will be chucked away.
Well, the others don't say that. They're just starting up these companies.
Well, naturally, people who run the company, they don't say so. There is another school of people who argue precisely the opposite. They say if only it wasn't spent on armaments, it could be usefully spent on developing British industry.
That's right.
That is your point, but they forget this, of course. If British capitalism disarms, British capitalism disappears. And of course, there's also another thing. Every now and then, all through the 19th century and in this century, the capitalists, the big capitalists in the world, have at a certain stage got together to try to reduce their armaments. Like they did in the 1930s with the Naval Treaty, and one of the purposes of the SALT Treaty, so that they can mutually agree to keep it from getting out of hand. Oh no, that isn't true. You see, the people who pushed it in the first place, when oil prices were about a fifth of what they are now, they had thought they'd got it worked out, they could make a profit. They might have been wrong, they might have made a mistake, but when oil prices doubled and doubled and doubled again, Concord was impossible to make a profit with it. About it being a very perfect machine, I mean, this is rather irrelevant from a capitalist point of view. You remember when Rolls-Royce went bust in 1971, it was because they had a manager who thought that his job was making aeroplane engines, and he was like, no. He was a technician, and his job was making profit, and he didn't know anything, he didn't know about it. Oh no, it is an important factor. And they've got various schemes for training unemployed people. I believe Sweden is a country that's done it more than anybody else, where they automatically, as soon as they're out of work, the government gives them retraining in other fields. And the British government, in theory, have adopted the same principle, but they, so far, have produced very little result. Even now, in the midst of this depression, there are companies reporting they can't get skilled workers, able to do their particular skill. One of the factors in this country is, of course, rent control. It destroys the mobility of the workers. The workers are in control, the house is in control, he's not going to move, no matter what the attraction is, he's not going to move to another town where he's got to pay an uncontrolled rent.
Can I come in on this point? Comrade here brought up the disproportion. You see, I always thought that the crisis being caused by the overproduction was wrong, and it was more a disproportion But I thought the disproportion applied to the cash. I've got down here that you say the disproportion is between the productive goods and the consumer goods.
The industries producing them, yes.
And these are the things that clash and come up the walls. Well, I always thought it was the cash mechanism.
Well, in what way?
In this direction, in other words, through investment, not through investment, in investment, in this direction of cash, and naturally being attracted towards the profitable industries, like, say, today, it would be going in for oil and gold and bankers. Starving the other, whether necessary or not, the building industry, the engineering industry, the steel industry, not that in private hand, starving those profitable industries of necessary cash to get into expansion, new machinery or whatever is required. And therefore not even getting as far as you or what you call it from the physical sort of situation, the attributes. I thought that the whole crisis took place even before the situation of production. It was a misdirection and a disproportion of the actual cash going in for investment. The difficulty in administering that cash, because in Finland, let me give you an idea of the London Transport, where they have a physical problem of toing and froing, ending up to 10 million, certainly 8 million people, throughout London, during most rush hour to get into the place of work. And they're quite confident they can do it. This is the GLC, the Master of London Transport. But the thing that seems to be holding up the works is not the physical production of that service, but the cash administration, to a point where last week it's being put by some of the main councillors in the GLC. Look, the community is where you give up the bloody fares, open the door, let the people in and out, and you'll get into work. Otherwise, if you keep on with this idea of 10 penny fares, 20 pence fares, 8 penny, the whole thing's going to suffer, come a crunch and break down.
Yeah, but all you're saying is that London Transport can't pay its way because people are going to work in their own cars. They're not using petrol money. In other words, this is an unprofitable industry. But, you see, capitalism not only has to have the bankruptcy of unprofitable industries, it can't survive any other way. I mean, suppose you'd had Labour governments and carried out their ideas and tried to keep the canals going and the stagecoaches going and all the rest of it. You let them go past. And as Marx pointed out, this is how capitalism gets out of its periodical depression. Because they go past. If they can't make a profit, who wants them? And if you don't do this, how do you develop new industries if you're keeping the old ones going by subsidizing?
But if that's true, Dave, that complements my point that either it's not the physical production of the thing. It's not the physical production of plumbers, bricklayers, and you can do all that. But somehow or other, can neither get the money or the not got enough of the money.
But where's the money going to come from?
What's it going to be for?
If they could make a profit out of London Transport, they wouldn't have to go to the government and say, give us another 100, 500 million. They'd go to the market and say, we're raising shares for London Transport. The capitalists would invest their money. Capitalists won't invest their money in this because there's no profit in it.
They won't borrow any money either if they're not going to expand,
Well,
no, I'm not really sure I don't really understand what you mean by disproportional cash. See, are you saying there's not enough cash?
For certain industries are not profitable.
Well, that's right. But this is how capitalism works. You can't have capitalism in which you keep unprofitable industries going.
Yes, but you see, if you speak about this, the clogging up of that due to the overproduction, I think it's speaking after the fact.
Look at the actual London Transport, of course, didn't really enter into this because London Transport has been subsidised for years. But look at the actual, take 1973, where money had been poured into the steel industry and expanded it, and they suddenly found they'd got twice as much steel as they wanted. It had been put into shipbuilding, and they found they'd got idle shipbuilding. It had been put into motor cars, and they found they got too many motor cars. This is how capitalism works. How would capitalism ever develop new industries if on your line, they poured the money into the old ones and kept these lame ducks floating.
Well, the answer is they can't do that on the very term of disproportion.
No, but you see, the disproportion is Marx's term, the disproportion between production goods industries and consumption goods industries. And this they are keeping balance from each other, bound to trouble. You see, in order that the production goods industries and the consumption goods industries could keep in line, you've got to have the production goods industries able to sell enough of their machinery and factories and so on to the other industries every year to be able to pay wages to their workers to go and buy consumption goods. If they can't do it, you've got disproportionately, you're in trouble. See, as soon as the motor car industry and shipbuilding overproduced in 1973, they started cutting back. The car people stopped producing cars and they stopped investing in cars. You would be appeared to say they ought to have invested more in it. But if they'd invested more in it, they'd have still more overproduction.
No, comment. No, I'm not trying to rectify that. I'm not trying to solve the problem by saying if you can keep abreast this consumption and producer goods. And then, of course, that's the crisis solved. And what I'm saying is that the crisis is not in the disproportion of the productive goods as opposed to consumer goods. Well, I'm saying the proportion all the time is in the actual cash terms.
Yeah, but then see, where's the cash coming from?
You're saying that the people that if the consumer goods industries are doing well, the workers in the producer goods industries are idle and starving and haven't got the money.
No, they haven't got the money
to buy them.
But that's your point. You must in fact be saying that somebody should subsidise these unprofitable industries, but where does the money to come from? You see, what you'd have to be saying is that the capitalists in the profitable industries should give the government more money in taxation so that they could keep the lame ducks floating. But the profitable capitalists don't want the lame ducks kept floating.
Well,
honestly,
I'm not trying to cause a solution. All I can see is instead of this disproportion, an overproduction of consumer goods at any time, as opposed to an overproduction of production.
Or the reverse, by the way.
I'm saying that at any time, crisis or otherwise, there's this constant and the disproportion of investment.
Well, it's got to be, isn't it?
Well, I think the point.
The
emphasis is on the matter of cash and not on the business.
Just a moment.
How is this cash flow
He hopes there'll be a profit, so he'll invest it.
Well, it comes down to your choice. But it comes against this employment, because if you don't want this withdrawal, you see, then you gain that change of money from one to put into the other. He's starving one, isn't it?
Yeah, because there's no profit in it.
Yeah.
I mean, take my example of stage coaches. See, why haven't they kept the stage coaches going? With road competition, they can't make the railways pay in this country. You know, in Canada, the railways are booming because distances are much longer. In this country, after the war, the Labour Party had a program. They were going to keep all the heavy traffic off the roads and make them put it on the railways. But the road transport lobby was so strong, they got it killed. And so the railways can't pay. And it doesn't matter how much money you put into the railways, you're not going to make them pay. Not on the side there, they might possibly make a small railway system.
And it's a big mistake to think you need to subsidize.
But it must be subsidizing, you see. If there's no profit in it, the capitalists won't put their money in, so then
The government's got to do it, and the only way the government can do it is taking money away from the capitalists who are making big profits and putting it into the industries where they can't make a profit.
Oh yes, but they buy it from the, see, in the main, the consumer industry, like the food manufacturers and the clothing manufacturers, don't make their own machinery. They buy it from the production goods, and there is a certain amount of overlapping. And incidentally, why the government makes three divisions of it: investment goods, consumer goods, and what they call intermediate. I mean, which curiously they put motor cars in the intermediate. I don't really know. I mean, they will have some reason. They've probably written it up somewhere. But I mean, when you think of the hundreds and hundreds of industries and subdivisions, when they're sitting down trying to work it out, they're going to be in some difficulties, and they allocate them one way or the other.
Okay, I have a question. I suspect it might be the last one we have time for, but I wonder if you would comment on the view that has been expressed in the Socialist Standard at least two or three times in the 1970s by one contemporary writer for it, that the markets of capitalism are contracting, and that the shrinking markets seem to be a feature of capitalism.
Well, particular markets contract, but the total market may have a setback in the depression, but it then expands again. This is the old Engels-Kautsky view, 1880s, where Engels said the market would never grow again, and Kautsky said the market would shrink. And I already mentioned British capitalist market is at least four times as large now as it was in the 1880s. And if you look at the United Nations statistics, the whole world, you'll find that the world market has continued to grow at a slower rate even during the depression.
So you repudiate that analysis of crisis?
I think that it's, well, it's no explanation of a crisis. And may I put you one? There have people who held a view, and they put it in these forms, they said, look, the crisis is due to general overproduction. Incidentally, Marx used the term general overproduction, he meant something different. Where they say that all industries are overproducing. Well, may I ask you to try to think to yourself, how can all industries be overproducing at the same moment? You see, one industry's production is another industry's market. If the motor car industry were to double, it doubles the market for components and all the rest of it. In other words, their market's increasing. So it seems to me that the idea that you can have all industries simultaneously overproducing is meaningless. Overproducing for what? Because if one overproduces, it increases the market for all the others, I mean, in its product. You can't produce another million motor cars without expanding the market for the components people in the steel industry. And I think the term really is meaningless, that you cannot have general, simultaneous overproduction of everything. Mm. But you can, of course, have Marx's idea that it's overproduction for particular markets, and that it's due to the disproportion of production in those different in those different sections of industry. And I would like, by the way, to deal with one little bit that I didn't deal with tonight. It is something Marx dealt with, the idea that capitalism gets out of a depression by an expansion of bank lending. Marx said this was nonsense enough. It wouldn't take long, but I would like to deal with that as well.